I want to talk about the great challenge that human beings deal with. To me, it could be the greatest challenge. Some would say the great challenge in human life is how to survive. Some would say it's how to stay healthy, how to earn money, how to know God, and on and on. But today I'm thinking it's somewhat different than that. I think the great challenge for human beings is this: how to get what we want. How to get what we want. Think about that for a moment. Isn't that what we are focused on most of the time? How to get what we want? Just think of the variety of ways that mankind tries to get what it wants. And think of the number of things that human beings want. Both of those things are absolutely amazing. We start out in life expressing displeasure with what is. I'll call that condition. And we want to display that displeasure to alert people to what we want and to what we need. The process of getting others to give us what we want is essentially like early programming. It's just hardwired. It's programmed into our system that we're going to operate like that. It's almost as if it's version one, basic level, getting what we want. And as we start to grow, we advance pretty quickly to taking what we want. As little children, as soon as we can grasp stuff, that sometimes that's even before we're able to walk, we are grasping stuff with our hands, trying to get a hold of it. So infants and young children take what they want. They look around, and whatever they can perceive, those things they find interesting, they reach for, they try to take. They take toys, they put stuff in their mouths, they throw some things, they create piles of other things that they like, and it goes on and on. Later on, and I presume that this is true in all cultures, but I'll speak specifically to the Western culture, that more complicated energy flows are established about getting what we want. Instead of the simple, you have it, I want it, I take it, that's almost caveman in its nature, right? You can hear that. The concept of exchange enters into the relationship. And if we look back in history, we could say, oh, that's how barter systems came into being, because barter systems describe this principle. You give me a dozen eggs from your chickens, and I'm going to give you a gallon of milk from my cow. We go, okay, this is how it works. Yep, I got it. But then later on, we become more sophisticated in our relationship of getting what we want with the creation of a medium of exchange. And for most of us in this lifetime, it is money. That's what we use. We don't exchange the cow's milk and the eggs, but in fact, we use money. So we both sell our eggs and our milk, in whatever form those happen to be in our lives, those are metaphoric, to other people for money. Now we have money. We possess money, and we use that money to buy another person's eggs or milk or potatoes or wheat or corn or iPhones or computers or electricity or whatever else we want. We use money for that purpose, because money makes exchanging for what we want far more convenient than the barter system. It'd be really difficult and challenging to walk to your power company and say, I need this many kilowatts of electricity, and here's this many dozens of eggs, or this many gallons of milk, or this many mowings of your lawn. It's like, yeah. We exchange our time, and not just our time, but our talent, and not just our talent, but our mind power, our manual skills, our awareness for money. And that exchange for money is what helps us in the pursuit of getting what we want. As we theoretically mature in years, well, I think we all mature in years, and this is the theoretical part, we grow in knowledge, the value of our time increases, because that hour now an hour of our time when we were 5 years old is different than an hour of our time when we were 15, 25, 35, 45, 55. It's different because of the energy, the information, the skill, the knowledge that we've accumulated, and we show up with that whole repository of awareness and deliver it during that hour, or at least we can. Now, you recognize that some business exchanges are time-based for payment purposes, and others are not. As the skill level rises, generally speaking, so will the price of that unit of time. As an example, a master electrician, if they were to come to our houses, would get paid more than an apprentice electrician. An intern in a hospital would get paid less than, say, the head of surgery. And the reason for that is because we say that, and we promote education as the means to gain knowledge, skill, to increase the value of a person's participation in society. If you have more education, your ability to contribute to society is going to be greater. And on the other hand, not only that, but your ability to participate in the economic flow, that is money coming to you, is going to be greater. The more knowledge we have and the more skill we have, the more leverage and influence we believe we will have to get what we want. The more money we have, the more we believe that we will be able to leverage circumstances and to be able to get what we want. In most of our environments, we're faced with this, I'll call it a fundamental question. Will I get more of what I want more often if I give or if I take? Now, most people don't ask themselves that question, but I think that goes on silently in the background, and it's a function of learning. Now, common sense is going to say, well, I think you need to balance giving and taking with giving. However, human consciousness is sometimes completely devoid of common sense, and we can be really driven by a lower awareness ego that thinks taking is the highest value. Taking is the best way to get what I want. Let's go back to what we want. What do we want? What do we want? That's not an easy question. If I go back in time, I think in terms of the Baltimore Catechism. Baltimore Catechism was used in early Catholic education in my day, and it said we should, emphasis on the should, we should want to know, love, and serve God. I'm guessing that other religions have similar shoulds. Now, I do know of people whose relationship with God is really about obedience. They accept their need to be obedient. That's what they're trying to do. They want to be on or expect themselves to be on a yo-yo string, and when they get pulled in one direction, they want to go in that direction. They don't want to resist. They don't want to think for themselves. They don't want to break that string. They don't want to do wrong. So they think that obedience to God is really the highest value, and it's designed for some of them to avoid making God mad. The last thing they want to do is make this person sitting up on a cloud angry with them. And they want to do it for a couple of reasons. They want to avoid punishment. That angry God can do some bad things according to the books, right? They could smite them, turn them to salt, and you name it, goes on and on. But it essentially boils down to two things. Punishment here when they're alive, so they're going to suffer. Oh, bad things will happen to them. They'll have bad luck. All kinds of things will go wrong in this lifetime. And then when they die, worse yet, they go to hell. It's like, for eternity, this is not a good thing. So this belief that obedience is the highest value really is a real challenge for them, because now it's like, what do you want? So it's not about what I want. It's what I'm trying to avoid. That's more important. I think that sabotages a person. I think of alignment with divine intention as being different than obedience to a set of rules and rituals that have been designed by man and said to be designed by God. God told me to tell you to obey the following rules. It's like, oh, really? Really? A superstitious person saying that this is God's will is not the same as that being divine intention. And following that set of rules and rituals and procedures out of a sense of fear is not the same thing as aligning with divine intention, which is really what most of us are thinking we ought to be doing and we want to be doing and we're designed to be doing. Here's a hypothetical situation. If we could ask a developing fetus about its desire to know, love, and serve God, it might respond that it's in the process of knowing God as it draws life from divine consciousness through its mother's body into its developing body. That's how it knows God. It could say that its mother, as far as it can tell, is God. Mother is the God it knows. Now, maybe as the spirit of that baby matures, if you will, and identifies more and more with its physical body, now it associates its mother's moods, emotions, actions, choice of food, its mother's intentions, the sounds that emanating from the mother or the mother's environment with a godlike power. And, if you think of it, the mother has the power of life and death over that fetus. And so, for all intents and purposes, that mother is the first God that that developing fetus is going to come in contact with. So you think of it. First 9 months of development represents the primary physical exposure to mother as God. Then the birth process represents a major event. Sometimes it's cataclysmic in the baby-God relationship. This God, by the way, is written in my own mind as a lowercase g, as to differentiate it from, you know, divine consciousness, which is God with a uppercase g. It would be easy enough for us to imagine this. Just think of that newborn baby nursing on its mother's breast, as feeling after it was squawking, you know, expressing its displeasure, being hungry, not being held. Now all of a sudden it's being held, being fed, could hear the heartbeat of its mother again, which is really what it's been familiar with for a period of 9 months. It's like, oh, I found God again. And it's warm, and it's loving, and it's nurturing, it's comforting. I have a sense of connection. I have a sense of security. This is what God is like. Well, maybe it is. Maybe it is. Maybe we need to see if we can't rehabilitate that set of images. But then as a child starts to grow, and let's say post-nursing, if you will, then we start to think and we start to move toward more physical representations of God. Material objects can become gods to us. Attention from others can be gods to us. Because we can feel the vibration of what it feels like to have what we want. We grab a thing, a physical object, and go, ooh, that feels good. I feel somehow connected. I feel somehow secure getting what I want. Ah, this is godness. I remember this back when I was in utero, and I remember this when I was nursing. Yeah, this is the same feeling. That's what it is. That's what it is. That's what I want to do. And so what we're looking to do is to have this energy flow coming to us that makes us feel secure and connected. That's what we want. And you go, ah. And we'll do pretty much anything to keep that energy flow coming toward us. Wait a minute. Let me just see. Is that what we want? Is that what we want? A flow of energy coming to us? Well, that's what a developing fetus needed. That's what a newborn baby wanted, a flow of energy coming to them. Now, they're somewhat different, right? One is coming through the umbilical cord and another is coming out of a mother's breast. But that's it. So now the question becomes, how do we get a flow of energy coming to us? We want it coming to us. We want it coming to us, this energy flow. Now, a caveman or a cavewoman with no understanding of spiritual laws would say, there's no energy flow. There's no energy flow. There are solid objects, and if you want them, you take them. You take them even if that means you have to club someone or something else that wants that same solid object. You can look at a solid object and say, hey, that's a solid object. It's not doing anything. There's no flow. There's no energy. It's just a solid object. If we took that cave person and used a time machine and brought that person to present time, and we're going to show them money as a medium of exchange, it might be an interesting conversation. Right? Here they come. Fast forward. Here they are today, and we're showing them money. Let's start with showing them a $20 U.S. currency. They would go, see, I told you. It's a solid object. It's a piece of paper with stuff on it. It's solid. We would go, oh, wow. Actually, it's a particle in an energy flow. We can see it now as solid. It's a solid object. Yep, I agree with that. It's a solid object. We can hold it between two fingers or hold it in our hands because we've stopped its movement. That's kind of like if we were to scoop a cup of water out of a moving stream and then looking at a molecule or a particle of that water under a microscope, we would say, it's not moving. It's not moving. It's like, yeah. And the cave person might say, you know what, I'm sorry, but I don't see that. It's a solid object. And if I want solid objects, I take them from whomever or whatever has them. It's like a pear tree. I go to the pear tree and take a pear off the branch. Period. End of story. Solid object. I see it. I want it. I take it. How did that valuable pear get on the end of the branch of that pear tree? Cave person now scratching its head or some part of its body going, I don't know. I don't know how it got there. I don't know how it got on the end of the branch. We'd say, consider this. The pear got on the end of the branch because the pear tree has knowledge of how to take an invisible flow of energy from the soil, from the air, from the invisible, and translate those energies into a strong tree, into roots, into branches, into leaves, and then into the fruits that we call pears. Cave person, are you saying that the tree takes these energy forms and gives them the various parts of itself, gives them to the various parts of themselves, including the fruit, so they can all grow? Let me see if I can understand that. The tree takes these energies and distributes them, gives them to these pieces of itself, the roots, the branches, the leaves, and then to the fruit. And that fruit grows because there's a flow of energy being directed into the fruit. Is that what you're saying? Yes. That's what we're saying. Because the brains, or the intelligence, or the consciousness, they mean in this sentence or so, the same thing, of the tree. The tree's consciousness knows to give the energy to its fruits. And it knows it's going to draw these energies in through the roots, the tree, through the bark, through the leaves, and to be able to do that. K person might say, that would mean if I gave energies to other people, other objects of attention, other things that I see, that they would grow and I would pull or attract more energy into myself? Yes, it would mean that. It would mean that. And because we have different intelligence than a tree, pear tree, apple tree, any kind of tree, any kind of anything, we have a different consciousness, a different intelligence, that the fruits that human beings can bear are more than just baby human beings. We can direct our attention, we can direct this energy flow that we pull in from the divine into whatever we want to create. Drawings, books, things we want to cook, babies, and even bombs. The variety of fruits that human beings produce are amazing. Well, that brings me to this question, the caveman says. What determines the fruit of human activities? The intentions we have as we translate. That's what it does. We make a decision. Unlike the tree has very limited choices in this regard. A pear tree can produce pears. We can produce an infinite number of things. If we intend to take, regardless of other people, we will bear bitter fruit because other people are going to react to that. If we intend to balance give and take, with the act of giving coming first, we're going to be happier with our harvest. Any farmer knows before they take the harvest, they give during the planting season, during the growing season. There's no mystery there. There's no mystery there. Farmers understand that. A lot of the rest of us don't in our work. But this process brings me to the second step of that statement of know, love, and serve God. Offering love to the object of our attention puts the energy flow in the center of our lives, and it's this flow of energy coming to us and through us is what we want. We want to be the distributors of God's love, not the hoarders, not the greedy grabbers of these energies. And as we are the distributors, more comes to us. We benefit from that process of distribution of God's energy. It's not just we're like a hose that is all throughput and we don't benefit from it. We benefit. We grow in our capacity to appreciate it, to become aware of it, to experience it, to understand it. So as we give, we clearly get. So as we distribute, we are being rewarded for that particular act. As we circle around in this talk and think, you know, about getting what we want, it seems to me that this great challenge, how to get what we want, may have two lesser but still important challenges. What is it that we want, and where does what we want come from? Now, if you turn on TV and you were to look at an ad, for instance, people will tell you that we want physical things. The reason we want physical things, according to the advertisers, is because it's easy for them to sell physical things. It's easy to see physical things. It appears and appeals to people who are 5 cents oriented that, oh, physical things. I can understand that. I can see it. I can touch it. I can measure it. I can lift it. It's real. It's real. But if we're more conceptual and we think in terms of the abstract and we can believe in and deal with invisible ideas, we're going to be apt to go, you know what? The physical is really a symptom of a couple of other things. And in my model, I think it's a symptom of up the line, if you will, in the manufacturing or the solidification into physical things, you will find emotional energies. And above that, you'll find mental energies. And above that, you'll find spiritual energies. So what do we want? Do we want the physical object, or do we want the vibration that we can access if we have the physical object? One of the interesting things with healing and the studies of pharmaceuticals, for instance, is the idea of the placebo effect. The placebo effect takes into consideration the idea that the belief system, the receptivity, the openness, the mindset of the person taking this chemical has a dramatic impact on the effects of that. So when they're trying to prove that a drug is effective, what they're looking to do is to be able to find out who has that mindset and then include them in getting the drug. And if they find somebody who's got the mindset that nothing works, everything is bad news, they try to put that person into the placebo to be able to skew the results. So at the end of the test, they would go, oh, look, the people over here that took the drug got much more dramatic results than the people who took the placebo, which proves the point that this drug is really good. It's like dudes. It proves the point that a person's mindset controls this energy flow that allows us to get what we want or doesn't allow us to get what we want. Like, and it's not the chemical so much. It is the mindset controls the valve, controls our openness, controls our access to getting what we want. So, if that control over what we want is our mindset, what do we want? I want a mindset that opens to my highest good and closes off to my lower level desires or awareness or my ego. I want that valve to work correctly and effectively for me, so I'm always at any fork in the road, any decision point, I'm choosing the higher vibration out of those. That's what I want. And what does that give us? It gives us access to higher vibrations all the time, because that's what we set ourselves up for. That's what we've trained ourselves to do. That's what we've done by elevating our awareness to be able to discern the higher value in any circumstance. And to know, I want the vibration, not the physical thing. I want the vibration. And to be able to reach for those of love or joy or peace or compassion or generosity or laughter or fun or kindness, all those things that should be really obvious that we all want in our lives, a sense of security. Security is a sense that we feel. Security is a vibration. It's not a gun. It's not barbed wire. It's not an attack dog. It's not an alarm system. It's a vibration. But the people peddling physical objects would say, it is a gun. It is an attack dog. It is barbed wire. It is an alarm system. And for those of us who fall for that, we'll succumb to going for the physical. And then we need another one. Then we need another one. What if the bad guy has a gun bigger than my gun? Now we're into this arms race, which is really, my physical thing has to be bigger than the other guy's physical thing. Hello. That is taking us down the path to the lower vibration where the ego is making these sorts of decisions of comparison, and it takes us away from what we really want. We have a great opportunity to reach out in thought and feeling to divine consciousness and ask for enlightenment. Enlightenment. Do we want enlightenment? Do we want enlightenment? Well, I don't know. It sounds like enlightenment could be some, do I have to be in a cave meditating for 50, 60 years in order to achieve that? I don't think so. I don't think so. If I were to say that enlightenment is the ability to discern in any single decision, any single set of choices, the one that contains the most light, and go toward that. Choose the one with the most light in it. Is it enlightenment? We want to take in light. So if we go toward the light, which is the greatest of all advice I think you can give to a person on their deathbed, go toward the light. But it's probably the best possible advice that we could give to that developing fetus. We could give to the baby as labor starts, and we could give to the baby as it's being born. Go toward the light. And if every decision that we made was a function of go toward the light, go toward the light. Not the temporary satisfaction of needs, but go toward the light. to be able to cause light to ripple forward in other people's lives, not only our own, but in other people's, that would be a mighty good thing. So what do we want? What do we want? How do we get what we want? We choose that we want light, and then we choose to distribute it, allowing God to work for us, in us, and through us. And if we know that we've got those three things going on at every single moment, then how to behave in any single moment seems so much clearer to us. Not only do I know what I want, I know how to get it. I know how to be, what to do, what to have. And let me help other people do the same thing. I would like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from letter 8 in the book Christ Returns Reveals Startling Truth. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness. And as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.